Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may have a position in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation or the content of this podcast. Do your own research.
Welcome, Jacqueline Daniel, to the All Points West podcast. Jacqueline is the chief executive of Crimson Tide, which is an AIM-listed software and technology firm that does work for a pretty broad spectrum of corporate and public sector customers, including the likes of Tesco, the NHS, catering giant Compass Group, the coffee brand Illy, and Chiltern Railways. Jacqueline was appointed CEO of Crimson Tide in August 2022 after holding the position of non-executive director since January 2021. She has more than 16 years' experience as founder, director, and CEO of education businesses that use digital technology to drive positive change for young learners and the wider education sector. Her early career centered on securing investment in regeneration and infrastructure projects to support public sector visions for strong local economies and good quality of life, winning the award for global action in 2000. Welcome, Jacqueline. Could we start by explaining in layman's terms what Crimson Tide does for its customers and an overview of the proprietary software MPro 5 that you use to embed into customers' back office functions?
Okay, yes. What does MPro 5 do? Well, at a very basic, essential level, MPro 5 is a business process management app. So most businesses consist at a basic level of a series of operations. So that might be a collection of scheduled pieces of work. We call those jobs in MPro 5. There might be a collection or sections containing questions that need to be answered, perhaps sequentially, by different members of different teams in different areas of that business. And we call those flows. Or a process might be something that requires to query some real-time data. So MPro 5 makes all of those processes automatic. And for smaller businesses, it removes the need for any paper or any offline actions. And it makes all that data and all those processes very consistent, very reliable. You know, it removes that room for error. And then the more digitally sophisticated businesses will often use IoT, so Internet of Things and devices to trigger alerts and actions. So hardware.
Give us a for example there.
Yeah, sure. So we're in a wide range of sectors, as you've said there, but we do focus in facilities management businesses, retail businesses, particularly grocery retail, and food service. So let's take grocery retail, and the big one there that everybody knows about is Tesco. So in that example, there could be sensors, so cameras or video, that is using data or creating data and putting it into the app, the MPro 5 app. And that app ingests that data and it can aggregate it and display it on a dashboard. It can send notifications. It integrates to all their third-party systems and it can create a remedial action. So I'll give you something really sort of simple and basic, if you like. So imagine you're in Tesco's and there's a bit of a puddle in aisle 5, and that's been created by, I don't know, a dropped pint of milk. That issue will have been detected by a camera, and the task in MPro 5 has automatically been created. It will send a message, an alert to the nearest available operative to say to that person, go and, you know, deal with that situation. This is the job that needs to be done. And they will do that. And then they will say that they've done that and provide the evidence on their mobile phone. Okay. And in an ideal situation, that issue will be fixed long before the store manager has even realized that it's happened. And probably he'll only realize maybe when he or she has got an email alert to say that job has been completed. So that's a very typical example.
Yeah. I mean, I read the I read this bit on your website about the Tesco contract. I guess crucially there in that example, it also hopefully will avoid any potential accidents involving either staff or customers. And I think I read again, forgive me if I've got the figure wrong, that it's essentially helped Tesco's to avoid something like 25 or 26 million in costs relating
claims.
To accident claims.
Yes.
Which is pretty, that's a big chunk of change, even for Tesco's. And also you've saved them something like £1 million on printing costs because it's all digitized.
Yes, absolutely. And that's the same across any business, because facilities management particularly, there is a requirement to be clean, to be safe, to be compliant. And that's what MPro 5 does very, very easily and simply. So you're always making your auditing process very simple, straightforward. And it means that, you can remain compliant in every situation. So absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. The other big contract that kind of caught my eye is that you also work for the NHS. Could you give us a flavour of the sort of service that you provide to the NHS and how is that relationship going?
Yes. Well, again, that's facilities management. So that's not the medical side of the NHS, if you like. The NHS operates something called a 50-point check, which again is about, auditing and compliant, clean and safe. So exactly the same kinds of jobs and flows and trigger alerts and actions as in the example that I've just given to you. Obviously, that focuses on, cleaning and very much more on compliant. They have, strict standards that have to be adhered to. And so, it's the same type of jobs and flows that MPro 5 is automatically triggering with remedial action. And they probably use IoT to a lesser extent at this time, but that is coming. And that is something that MPro 5 has brought into them.
Now, presumably, crunching all that data will kind of enables the NHS, I guess, NHS managers to identify bits of the NHS estate that are particularly kind of, that get heavy traffic and are pretty well worn and maybe, need more regular cleaning, more regular checks. What you do is able to kind of alert the cleaning crews there to, to get to maybe drop something that's that they are currently working on, and in order to, quickly kind of go and see something.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, and that's what we call reactive cleaning. Absolutely. Yeah. And it can also sort of reschedule, cleaning schedules automatically, so that, it's making better use of the manpower available. It's much more efficient. But not just cleaning, it could be, because of footfall, air temperature or air quality that's being measured by sensors. If a room isn't being used, it can turn the air conditioning off or adjust it automatically according to its usage and its requirement for usage. So, the energy cost savings and the benefit and the efficiencies that bring all adds to that, that management of that facility. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, this is kind of a form of AI, right? Am I right in saying that?
Yes.
Yeah. And obviously, there's been a lot of talk about how AI is going to change everything. And, most of the stuff that gets written and reported is kind of doomsday stuff about, how the robots are going to take over. But actually, what your technology is demonstrating here is that it's incredibly useful and potentially can, save large customers like the NHS and Tesco's and others huge sums of money and make them more efficient.
Yes, not just cost efficient, but customer experience is improved, matching any sort of compliance in terms of energy usage. It's really sort of leading the way in all these things that we hear about in sustainability. And I think the more sort of digitally advanced businesses are really taking the IoT to its proper artificial intelligence level.
Yeah.
You know, if something is happening on a regular basis, it changes its new normal automatically, so that we don't get alerts just because a set of data has been inputted. That data will change according to what's happening in reality, and that's the clever bit. So that you don't have to keep changing parameters of what you're telling the data to notify you of. It's very much a case with IoT. You know, you can have huge amounts of data that's aggregated and supplied in different ways and displayed in different ways, and that's terribly useful. But at the end of the day, so what? You know, what happens now? So you actually know how many people are passing through a railway station, or how many people are, during COVID, you know, wearing masks. So what? What are you going to do with that information? And that's where MPro 5 comes in with its AI. You know, it can trigger an action to happen, an automatic job or an automatic flow to take place as a result of the data that it's seeing.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit more about the NHS. How's the relationship going? Do you see that being a potentially much bigger customer, a much bigger job for you?
Yes, in time. I mean, the NHS is very sort of decentralized, as you know, and that will take a long time depending on their budgets. But absolutely, the areas that we're working in are growing all the time. I don't see it as the immediate growth opportunity, personally. Mm-hmm. I think that the immediate growth opportunity for us is in facilities management more widely, and grocery retail and food service. I think those are the much more immediate targets for us in terms of, you know, growing and scaling. But absolutely, it's such a, you know, it's such a broad range of sectors that we can service that we have to try and remain focused.
Is that because food retailers are, you know, currently far more digitally advanced than, you know, a big public sector body like the NHS, for instance, and you're able to integrate into that a bit more kind of easily?
I think it's several reasons. I think that we've already got quite a good foothold. So the work that's been done, I mean, don't forget, Crimson Tide has been around for quite a while. It was founded back in 1996. And although I only came to Crimson Tide 3 years ago, a lot has happened in that time. When I came, they were just embarking on what turned out to be a very successful fundraise. And that meant that a lot of investment could be made in the MPro 5 product, which started life out really as a CRM. So that investment has been very much focused on existing functionality and making those pre-configured, so offering out-of-the-box solutions with very instantly usable solutions for smaller companies. And it's very much advanced in the needs of those kinds of businesses, very familiar with the various jobs and flows that it needs to report on and action. So I think that's probably more of the reason than where that sector lies in terms of its digital growth journey, because you could have a very small, you know, grocery outlet that just wants to start off with these pre-configured solutions that it can use instantly, like any other app.
Yeah. I know you've been moving into the US market and you've have an office there. What can you tell us about the work that you're doing in the States? What's the potential for that arm of the business?
Yeah, well, once again, that sort of has its origins back in the successful fundraise. So I mentioned, you know, the investment in the product. There continues to be a lot of investment in marketing. So not just including the usual, you know, marketing strategies and the activities, but also, as you point out, extending our reach. So we have an entity in North America that is a small marketing hub operating out of the tech startup triangle in North Carolina. They have been successful, particularly in facilities management in North America, and reaching out to very similar companies across the pond where they can make use of MPro 5 in very similar ways where we're already operating. And don't forget that we're a global company anyway, in terms of not just in terms of our offices, but in terms of our existing customers, in terms of our partners. And so it's quite natural that we extend our operations into that territory, albeit, you know, marketing specifically to that culture and to those equivalent sectors in the US.
Yeah. Well, drop a few names here. What sorts of companies are you working with over in the States?
Well, we're working with partners because the way to scale, I believe, not only in the US, but probably throughout the rest of the world as well, unless you're going to be employing more and more and larger sales teams directly, then selling through our partner network, I think, is the way to go. And that's what we have been focusing on. We've always had an effective partner network. We haven't really deployed it as best that we are doing now. So working with people like Cisco, who are not only a partner, but also a customer. So we have quite a large case study in their head offices, in their San Francisco offices, which is all set up with sensors and cameras and dashboards. So it's not only actually being used for their own businesses, but it is a case study for their sales teams and their partners' sales teams and their partners' partners' sales teams, so that you can actually see MPRO5 in action. And that's where we are having the most success in the States. And I think that's where we will continue to have the most success going forward. And that's a typical example. There are other partners that we will be targeting over the next 12 months to 3 years. And that will, you know, will form our growth strategy in the US and other territories going forward.
Yeah, great stuff. Thanks for that, Jacqueline. I want to take you back to the start, if I may. Where did you grow up and what was that like?
That's a very difficult question. When people ask me, where are you from? I've always lived in the UK, but I was born in Matlock in Derbyshire. My parents quite quickly moved to Yorkshire and then to Somerset. And the joke was that by the time I was 11, I'd lived in seven counties. So I'm never really quite sure what to say. I tend to say the Midlands because I went to school in Worcester. So I'm from the Midlands, basically, yeah. But I've lived all over the UK. Yeah.
Why was that? What did mum and dad do when you were younger?
I think that my father was quite adventurous. He was a bit of a rebel. Interestingly, he was an early adopter of technology. And he was in the building industry at that point and was often buying property, the property that we lived in, that is, and then selling it on for a profit or getting a new desire to try somewhere else because that appealed to him.
A nomadic soul.
A little bit, yes. Later in life, they remained in the Midlands and they remained in the Worcestershire area. But he was very much kind of ahead of his time. I mean, I remember him having, I think it was about 1970, the Pulsar digital watch came out, very first one, you know, the LED. Of course, he had one of those. I thought this was amazing as a child. But he pointed out that it wasn't actually that good, that it was hype. Because you had now had to have two hands to tell the time. And even very shortly before he died, and he lived to be 92, he was looking into buying a new laptop. Right. So he was, you know, always very much into the next new thing and trying it out, but, you know, quite critical of it as well in a positive kind of a way. But, yeah, open-minded, I would say, and adventurous.
Yeah. And what about mum? What did mum do?
Mum came from a very traditional working class family. She was brought up in Hereford. I'd probably describe her as being a very sort of compliant woman, as they often were in those days, but emotionally very strong. And she met my father in Nottingham, where they were both on a Boots the Chemist training course. And she only ever worked part-time. She worked in shops. And then later in life, she, her children grew up, she worked at a special school for physically and mentally handicapped children, which she really enjoyed and went on to foster them. Okay. But that was something that she did once my father had retired. He was considerably older than her. So once he retired, yeah, she was kind of set free to do these things.
Okay. And what about siblings? Do you have brothers and sisters?
I have a younger brother who's very much into outdoor training, and he offers degree courses. And I have older half-brothers and sister from my father's first marriage. So like I said, he's right, considerably older than my mother, and my brother, younger brother, and I are part of that second marriage. Yeah. So yeah, we're very, very different people, I would say.
Okay. And you mentioned Worcester. So where did you go to school, and what were you like? Were you academic? Were you sporty?
I wasn't particularly academic. In those days, I sat and passed the 11 plus. And so I went to probably one of the last all girls grammar schools where I did my O levels. I didn't really enjoy the work at school. I went to school really to have fun. I didn't really apply an awful lot of focus, but I managed to get 8 O levels. And then I went on to do my A levels at technical college, because by then I'd had enough of school. I felt it was curbing my instincts. Of course, it wasn't. They were just trying to get me to focus and knuckle down and do some work. But I was always distracted by something, I think. So I got my A levels at technical college, and then I went on to study architecture at Nottingham University. So I've gone round full circle to where my parents met, and in fact, where I met my husband. And that's where I started my building career.
No, I was just going to say, what drew you to architecture?
That's a good question. I think I just liked the idea of it. My father had worked, like I said, in the building industry. He'd worked in a drawing office. He made very detailed, spectacular models. And I found this all fascinating. And I think I sort of romanticized the idea of architecture and design. And to a large part, that lived up to that fantasy, that romanticized idea of design. And I very much enjoyed that work. And my early career was spent in design offices, in architects' offices, both in the private sector and in the public sector, which I really enjoyed, and got the benefit of those studies. I didn't stay specifically in architecture. I took some further qualifications and studied part-time while I was working. So I did a diploma in building and joined the Chartered Institute of Builders. And then I went on and did, you know, the usual sort of management master's degrees, and eventually ended up doing town and country planning masters in Bristol. So I sort of moved my career and qualifications. So I moved out of drawing and design offices really into managing building contracts and that whole sort of execution on site, which was really enjoyable. And then there was quite a natural progression, I think, into land use planning. So now, as you mentioned earlier, covering much greater areas with master plans for regeneration. So big area-based improvement schemes in Birmingham that attracted private investment.
Yeah. So I've got your CV just so our listeners get a better picture of your career journey, which has been a pretty varied and interesting one. Mm-hmm. So going back to 1988, you were project officer at Birmingham City Council for about 3 years. Then you moved to Blaenau Gwent County Council as project manager for 13 years. I think I mentioned in the intro, you were owner and CEO of Interhigh Education for 9 years and a 5-year spell at Way Education. Then you joined MPro 5 as a non-executive director in 2021 before taking over as CEO of Crimson Tide in August 2022. Jacqueline, which one of those jobs or roles do you think had the biggest influence on you and your career?
I think they very much all played their part. So when I started working in architecture, and even when I was studying it, technology was playing a big part. I was working on AutoCAD in the early days. It was actually release 10. So we're talking about, you know, before Windows. That was very stimulating. when I moved towards building contracts, I was starting to use structural calculation software. No longer did I have to calculate U values manually, that there were, you know, software packages that could do this. And this was sort of magical. And then even when I went into the regeneration programs, there was big 3D modeling, you know, 3D studio was coming into that world. So yeah. That was quite a, and I was pretty much an early adopter myself. I mean, I remember having one of the first Xeon PDAs back in 1991, and I got a Sony PDA smartphone, and I thought this was fantastic because I could get all my email on it. So
yeah.
That technology link sort of ran through all of that. And then Way Education was the result of my husband and I founding a business called Interhigh, which was a SaaS business. It probably would be called ZAS now, which is, I think, is everything as a service. But we took that acronym of SaaS and basically applied it and said, right, you can have school as a service. So families and organizations basically subscribed to a fully interactive learning platform. So you could see that, again, it was that use of technology and this learning platform. You know, you could subscribe to a synchronous model, so you're learning in real time with live lessons, or you could subscribe to an asynchronous model where, you know, you could do it on almost on catch up. And it offered a very, what's called an adaptive learning. So the software was able to deliver a very custom learning experience to each individual learner. And there are huge parallels there with what we're doing at Crimson Tide. We're using technology to benefit the user or benefit the organization. We're using technology to make things effective and efficient and have a greater impact on their vision or on their ambition. I mean, I'm not a coder.
Yeah.
I'm not interested in ever becoming a developer, just like I'm not interested in being a mechanic, but I enjoy driving. But I have always loved what tech can do and how it can be used to really benefit you. You have to be discriminating and you have to be selective. You can't just follow the, you know, the usual tech hype and deployment. It's personal as well. You know, what's going to work for you? It's a bit like, isn't it, that kind of Gartner 5 stages of hype cycle. You've got to get straight to that, I think they call it plateau of productivity.
Yeah.
And that is the thread that has run through my career. That's what I have always been drawn to.
So I think what I'm hearing here is that essentially you are your father's daughter in that, you know, as you described your dad, you know, being quite enthusiastic about new technology without necessarily being an expert. I mean, what you're describing about yourself here is pretty similar.
I guess so. I guess so. Well, that was probably the introduction because, you know, it can really change your life.
Yeah.
No matter what business sector or what your personal circumstances are. Like I say, you've got to be discriminating, and there's a lot of tech out there that is just hype.
Of course.
I think ultimately, as long as it's, you know, creating a benefit, then what is not to like?
Yeah, absolutely. Jacqueline, just finally, before we part ways, could I just ask, what do you enjoy doing outside work in order to relax?
Well, I like working to relax. I'm still, you know, it's still something that I enjoy. I don't have a work-life balance. Work is an integral part of life. I'm very, very lucky in that respect that I can enjoy it. I'm lucky that I'm driven. I'm lucky that I've never struggled with ambition. And I think that's because I learnt quite early in my career that you've got to make sure that you do something where that there are trials and tribulations in every job, in everything that you do. And you've got to make sure as far as possible that you are able to enjoy that struggle. Because if you can't enjoy the struggle, then that's when it becomes problematic. But I am involved in things that are much more physical, if you like, in the physical world. So dancing, singing, acting, that kind of thing. But I really do enjoy, you know, my work as a hobby as well. Like I say, it's an integral part of life.
Jacqueline Daniel of Crimson Tide, thank you for joining me on the All Points West podcast. I wish you all the best with it.
Thank you very much.